This tape is entitled The New World Order, The Great Blunder, and it's given by Ed Griffin.
Actually, my talk today is half a talk. I've been working on this. It probably won't sound like it, but I've been working on this for quite a while, and it had a life force of its own. It began to grow. The New World Order. Good heavens, what is not included in that topic? It's like the world and everything in it. And I just let it go to see where it would wind up, and it took me into all of these various areas. And when I was all done with this outline, I realized that there were basically two presentations. And the larger presentation is what I call Novus Ordo, a second look at the New World Order. And the purpose of that larger presentation is to compare two groups which have adopted the New World Order as their operational slogan. One group was an ancient conspiracy called the Illuminati, and the other group is a very modern power elite of today. The people who run our lives indirectly from behind the scenes. Now, those are two topics. I believe we're talking about the New World Order as viewed as a conspiracy, and the New World Order as viewed as a gigantic blunder. I personally believe that there is a historic continuity between the ancient conspiracy and the modern power elite of today. But I'm the first one to tell you I cannot prove it. And in a topic of this kind, one has to be very defensive and one has to be very careful not to exaggerate and to prove everything. You don't have to exaggerate. It's bad enough exactly as it is. And so, even though I personally feel that there is historic continuity between these two groups, that will not be part of the presentation, of the larger presentation. As I said, it is broken into two parts. The conspiracy stands alone. That's part one. Today I want to talk to you about part two, which is the New World Order, the gigantic blunder. Because, ladies and gentlemen, even if you ignore conspiracy theories completely, the situation is serious enough. And whether or not there is historic continuity between these two groups is absolutely unimportant if it can be shown that the objectives of the current group are for all practical purposes the same as the objectives of the ancient conspiracy. Then what difference does it make? They have to be stopped. And so today I'm going to be talking about the gigantic blunder. The conspiracy part would start about 200 years ago and would end with current events. I'd like to begin now with current events and project certain patterns into the future. The phrase, the New World Order, actually first burst upon the American consciousness from a series of presidential speeches made by President Bush during the joint United States-United Nations war against Iraq. And people everywhere began to ask, what does this phrase mean, the New World Order? And I think to answer that question, we must first ask, what does President Bush mean? We must realize that President Bush is a longtime member of the world's power elite, the very group of which I am speaking. It is best identified, I think, by simply pointing to the Council on Foreign Relations and its various satellite groups. Had I been giving you the whole load, you would have known by now what the Council on Foreign Relations is all about, how it came into being, how it was an outgrowth of a very secret society funded by Cecil Rhodes and so forth. But let us forget all that. The Council on Foreign Relations exists today, It is a semi-secret organization, and it is very much in control of United States foreign policy. At least the members are. Its goal, without having to resort to secret documents at all, its goal is world government. We have to remember, too, that President Bush is very much in the Rockefeller sphere of influence, because it is the Rockefeller dynasty which dominates the Council on Foreign Relations. And so when President Bush ushers the phrase New World Order, he is reflecting the CFR mindset. All right, what is the CFR mindset? I believe that upon analysis you'll agree that the New World Order has actually three different meanings. Or perhaps a better way of saying it has three dimensions of meaning, depending upon your depth of understanding of what's going on in the world. The first dimension is for the general public. Basically, it means an end of the Cold War, cooperation with the Soviets, a world of peace and brotherhood, justice, prosperity, ecology, and so forth. All of the good things. The appeal there is to idealism and basically to the emotions. Now, the second dimension, if you look deeper than that, is primarily for scholars and opinion molders. The second dimension means conversion of the United Nations into a functional one-world government. Now, the appeal there is to a higher kind of idealism and to self-interest. When I say higher idealism, I'm talking about the idealism of intellectuals and theorists who like to talk about a better world and how it's going to work and the logic of it all. And the self-interest applies to the politicians and the bureaucrats who are sure that they're going to administer this thing and enjoy a favored status. And then there is the third dimension, where the action is really occurring, and it's strictly for those in the elite core, the enlightened ones, as it were, the enlightened ones who are planning to exercise hidden control over those politicians and bureaucrats who will have favored status. Specifically, I'm talking about a global collectivist oligarchy. I'll be defining those words a little bit later. But keep it in mind, this is the key to understanding the New World Order, a global collectivist oligarchy. And the appeal here is not particularly to idealism or to the intellect. It's simply to be in the oligarchy. Now, this is a very carefully guarded secret, ladies and gentlemen, and yet it is amazingly easy to discover. Let's take a look at the first dimension of the meaning New World Order. We find this in practically all of the public utterances. President Bush on September 11, 1990, in a television address to Congress and the nation, said, "Out of these troubled times, a new world order can emerge, a new era, freer from the threat of terror, stronger in the pursuit of justice, and more secure in the quest for peace. An era in which the nations of the world, east and west, north and south, can prosper in harmony." 2 months later, the president, on November 17, 1990, addressed the people of Prague in Czechoslovakia, and he said that the conflict in the Persian Gulf provided, and these are his words, "an opportunity to draw upon the great and growing strength of the Commonwealth of Freedom and forge for all nations a new world order far more stable and secure than any we have known." And by February of 1991, the president was using the first dimensional meaning in just about every major address. And it wasn't long before all of the, or at least many of the other administrative spokesmen joined in. Now, the second dimension is also very clear. On September 11, 1990, President Bush, in his address to Congress, made these comments. He said, "When we are successful, and we will be, we have a real chance at this new world order, an order in which a credible United Nations can use its peacekeeping role to fulfill the promise and vision of the United Nations founders. And 6 months later, on March 6, 1991, in an address to Congress, President Bush said, "Now we can see a new world coming into view, a world in which there is the very real prospect of a new world order, a world where the United Nations, freed from Cold War stalemate, is poised to fulfill the historic mission of its founders." Well, who were its founders? And what was its mission? When I wrote The Fearful Master way back in 1964, I was kind of a neophyte in this whole issue, and I listed 16 names who were part of the post-war foreign policy planning section of the State Department and other agencies of government, 16 people who were very influential in formulating United Nations policies, in drafting the United Nations Charter, and in formulating the policies that wound up in that charter. All of those 16 were members of the Communist Party. They were Americans, mind you, or at least American citizens. I wouldn't call them Americans, of course. But they had American citizenship. They were working for the federal government of the United States, and they were identified either at that time or shortly thereafter by other members of the Communist Party. They were identified as communists. Now, some of those were well known, like Alger Hiss, Harry Dexter White, and Laughlin Curry. There were some who were not so well known, more obscure, like Virginius Frank Coe, Noel Field, John Carter Vincent, and the like. Actually, ladies and gentlemen, these people were far more influential in the creation of the United Nations than the big front names, far more important than Truman, Churchill, and Stalin, because these were the people that actually hammered the structure of the United Nations together. Well, I wasn't wrong. But in the years that followed, my education continued, and I discovered something called the Council on Foreign Relations, which I didn't know very much about at that time. And lo and behold, I discovered that, yes, there were others also influential in the creation of the United Nations who were not members of the Communist Party, but who were, in fact, members of the CFR. And these names included such dignitaries as Dean Acheson, John Foster Dulles, and Nelson Rockefeller. Now, some of these CFR members were also members of the Communist Party, like Alger Hiss, Laughlin Curry, and Lawrence Duggan. But I have learned since that time that the Council on Foreign Relations was far more influential in the creation of the United Nations than the Communist Party, because they included the Rockefeller Group. And those are the people that carried the checkbook. And you know about that. The Rockefeller Group has dominated the Council on Foreign Relations during all of these years and has been in the forefront of the movement to strengthen the United Nations. Now, the question that comes to mind is, well, why on earth would members of the Communist Party and members of the Council on Foreign Relations actually work together in a project of this magnitude? And the answer is simple. Their goals are the same. Their goals are to create a global collectivist oligarchy. In short, their goal is world government with a capital G, with themselves in control. Well, what's wrong with world government? This is a question that sometimes we tend to skip over. I think it's a great ideal. It may surprise you to know that I have not abandoned that dream. When I was in school, I thought the idea of a world united in peace and brotherhood was a fantastic concept. And you know what? I still do. But what kind of a world government? Aha! These are the questions we're not supposed to ask. I mean, after all, if world government was the goal, with no further questions or considerations, this is what the emperors of Rome wanted. This is what Genghis Khan wanted, Tamerlane, Hannibal, Alexander the Great, Napoleon, Hitler, and so forth. They all wanted world government. If that was our goal and no further questions asked, then we should have just let Hitler take over the globe. But what kind is the question we have to learn how to ask, and that is the very question that the enlightened ones do not want us to ask. We must remember that we are not dealing here with a theoretical United Nations or a world government, or a possible United Nations or world government, or some future United Nations or world government. We are talking about the existing structure of the United Nations. And there's quite a difference. And that leads to the third dimensional meaning of the New World Order. Global collectivist oligarchy. Now it's finally time to get down and define those words. Let's start with collectivism. We have to first of all forget these old labels such as Republicans and Democrats, conservatives versus liberals, left versus right, socialism, fascism, democracy, capitalism, all of these words. Everyone has trouble defining those words, and they don't really convey the essence. What they mean in your mind may not be the same as in someone else's mind. In order to carry on any kind of a meaningful discussion on the topic, we have to get down to basics. And I believe that the basic concepts that we're dealing with here are the choice between two world views on how to accomplish good. The one group adopts the view of collectivism, and the other group adopts the view of individualism. Now let me explain as best I can. A collectivist is a person who believes that the group is more important than the individual, that the collective group is the highest unit of society, and that the rights and the needs and the wants of the individual must be sacrificed if necessary for the greater good of the greater number. The collectivist translates this concept into utilizing government as the vehicle for the realization of his goals. It's not just a voluntary thing, it's just we're going to use government to do it. Now the collectivist and the individualist both want basically the same thing, I have found. They both want justice, they both want the poor to be taken care of, they want all the good things. But they have different ways of accomplishing it. The collectivist says, let's use government to bring about all of these good things. In other words, he is saying, let us use force to force our fellow man to do those things which we know he should do. The individualist believes, on the other hand, that you can persuade your fellow man to do all the good things. You can show him by good example, but you must not force him to do the good things. It's a world apart in philosophy. So consequently, the collectivist believes that people should prepare for their old age. Does he encourage them to take out a savings policy? Does he encourage them to buy an insurance policy for that purpose? No. Let us have a law, he says. Now we will force these idiots to do it, whether they want to or not. And on down the line. You name whatever issue you wish, and the collectivist comes to the conclusion that the only way to accomplish this desirable goal is to use force. The individualist, on the other hand, is left trying to persuade his fellow man. The bottom line, ladies and gentlemen, is that the collectivist has no faith in freedom. The individualist believes in freedom. Even though it doesn't always work the way he wants it to work, he knows that it's the best in the long run. Unfortunately, many Americans today have no faith in freedom. Or if they have faith in it, they're afraid of it. They've been taught that it's not a good thing. The United Nations and the coming New World Order is built upon the solid bedrock of collectivism. It is firmly committed to that ideology, and Americans need to have a better understanding of what that word means. For example, the United Nations bedrock of collectivism is found in Article 55 and 56 of the UN Charter. Article 56 says, "All members pledge themselves to take joint and separate action for the achievement of the purposes set forth in Article 55. So what does Article 55 tell us? These are the achievements and the purposes. Quote, higher standards of living, full employment, economic and social progress, health, and related problems. Now, the Constitution of the World Health Organization defines health as follows. Health is a state of complete physical, mental, and social well-being, and not merely the absence of disease or infirmity. Governments have a responsibility for the health of their peoples, which can be fulfilled only by the provision of adequate health and social measures." Alger Hiss was one of the founders of the World Health Organization, and he said that health, quote, includes not only the more conventional fields of activity, but also mental health, housing, nutrition, economic or working conditions, etc. So you see where this process leads. The result of this concept is that the United Nations is becoming, if not already has become, a collectivist paradise. If you study the activities and the reports put out by the Secretariat, the daily reports, believe it or not, over 2 billion pages produced per year by the UN Secretariat on these things, you will see daily reports on setting prices, production quotas, national inventories and stockpiles of raw materials, labor standards, wages and monetary policies, tariffs, employment levels, population movements, birth control, saving the planet, allocation of food, clothing and housing, standards for nutrition, health care, retirement, education, nursery care, even standards for garbage collection. No exaggeration. The collectivist goal for the United Nations is a world forum, a world legislature, a world court, a world Department of Education, welfare agency, ecology corps, planning center for industry and commerce, a central banking system, treasury, currency, data bank, secret service, police force, army, and anything else you might want, or more specifically, might not want. So how are you going to pay for all this? Three guesses. Who is going to pay and how are they going to pay it? You are going to pay for it. Because, you see, this is a collectivist system, and the collectivists always gravitate to the concept of a progressive tax of some kind where those who have more pay more. Well, just in case you didn't know it, the American people have more. Now, we have adopted that principle in our own taxation structure here in our own country, so there is no basis for our objection when this tax structure is adopted at the international level. As it is, we already pay 25% of the total United Nations cost, and that, believe me, ladies and gentlemen, is just the beginning, just as soon as they have a means of enforcing a higher percentage. The United States has a higher gross national product than any nation in the world, and the United Nations collectivists are anxious to get their hands on it. They blame their own ills on our prosperity. The cry is to share the wealth, eliminate the disparities, and believe it or not, we are the target. But it's not so much the American people who are the target, because under any collectivist system, the enlightened ones know that it's the middle class that is really the target, because they do not want anybody in between the oligarchy at the top and the serfs at the bottom. They must have a very strong class society. Now, I mentioned the word oligarchy again, so here we come back to that one. It's the remaining word to be defined. I used to think that oligarchy was simply government by a few. And then I went to the dictionary and realized that that's not quite right. Get half credit for that. It's government by the few without consent of the governed. Because after all, every government is government by the few. You have to delegate certain powers to elected and appointed representatives. But the key here is without consent of the governed. Now, there are plenty of modern examples, but the most prominent of them are the Communist Party, which has the apparatchik, the civil servants who are appointed, and then above that, the very elite group, the Politburo, and the hidden ones that control the apparatchik. In our own present power elite in this country, we find that the group centers around the Council on Foreign Relations. These are the people that are influencing the major decisions of our federal government, and neither the Communist Party, the apparatchik, the Politburo, the Council on Foreign Relations, none of these people are elected. Both groups advocate collectivism. The only point of contention between them, really, where they come into apparent conflict, is who shall dominate. The New World Order is the solution for both groups. It is the solution by which they will share power in a global collectivist oligarchy. Now, these are rather sterile definitions, and they are, I understand, quite inadequate to explain what we're really facing. They're too intellectual. What will it mean in terms of the human condition? I would like to describe the case against the New World Order in very succinct terms that no one can miss. In fact, I have phrased them in a way to make them rather shocking, and then I will attempt to demonstrate that they are true. If the New World Order is built upon the existing United Nations, I say that mankind will be condemned to suffer under three perpetual conditions: oppression in the name of human rights, slavery in the name of democracy, and war in the name of peace. The remainder of this presentation will be devoted to demonstrating to the best of my ability that those are true statements. And I think most people would agree that if any one of them could be demonstrated as correct, it would be good reason enough to say no to the New World Order. So let's begin with oppression in the name of human rights. I'd like to just review for your memory the wonderful allegory Orwell's Animal Farm. If you remember, the animals on the farm became very dissatisfied because Farmer Jones was living so well, and they did all the work, the animals did, and they were becoming discontent with the class difference between the workers and what they saw as the exploiters. And the pigs, who were a little smarter than the rest of the animals, got them organized. And they agitated and told the rest of the animals that all they had to do was unite together and conduct a revolution, and everything would be better, a people's revolution, or in this case, an animal's revolution. And to demonstrate the great principles of this new revolution, the pigs went to the back of the barn. They got a ladder and got up the ladder, and holding between their hooves these paintbrushes, it was very crude lettering, but you could read it, and they wrote out the great principles of the revolution. These are four of the great principles. No animal shall drink alcoholic beverages. Now, that came because, you see, Farmer Jones was often seen getting pie-eyed drunk, and that was terrible. Also, Farmer Jones was seen sleeping in a bed. They didn't like that. And once in a while, Farmer Jones would slaughter one of the animals, and that was really bad news. So, the first of these great principles was, no animal shall drink alcoholic beverages. The second great principle was, no animal shall sleep in a bed. The third great principle was, no animal shall kill another animal. And the fourth and greatest of all principles was, all animals are equal. You can't argue with any of those, and the animals thought that was wonderful, and so they united behind the pigs, and they overthrew Farmer Jones. They kicked him out. He left the farm, and now the people's revolution took over. People's paradise was ushered in. Well, it didn't take very long before things began to go from bad to worse. The crops began to fail, and nobody was out there to till the crops. The windmill broke and nobody fixed it. The fence fell down. Nobody fixed it. The animals began to go hungry. There wasn't enough food. And their lot became very bad indeed, except, of course, for the pigs. Now, the pigs who were in charge of the whole operation were doing pretty well. In fact, they had moved into Farmer Jones' house. Not only that, one night, some of the animals crept up to the window and they looked in and they heard all this noise and they saw the pigs drinking alcoholic beverages. They saw the pigs sleeping in a bed. And when some of the animals objected to this, the pigs had them executed for being enemies of the revolution. And the animals were very confused. They said, "How can this be? This seems to be contrary to all of the great principles." And so they went back to the back of the barn to look at these great principles again and study them, and they saw that some letters and words had been added to the ends of these lines. They could tell because the painting was more fresh. And now the principles read, "No animal shall drink alcoholic beverages to excess. No animal shall sleep in a bed with sheets. No animal shall kill another animal without cause." And finally, the fourth and greatest principle of all animals are equal, but some are more equal than others. Okay, well, in the name of the people, that's the gimmick of the 20th century. Advances in technology have changed the face of totalitarianism. The old way was based on force, where the conqueror came in with military might, subdued a population, and held them down with his boot and his bayonet. That worked, but people resented it, and they eventually rebelled. Ah, the new way, the new technology, new means of communication, new means of mass control. Group dynamics, phrases, always in the name of the people. This way the conqueror accomplishes the same result, but with no resentment. How can you object? It's the people. And so we find that in today's world, words and images are more important than deeds and realities. Marx and Lenin were masters of the technique. They probably really ushered it in. Well, Hitler was pretty good, too. It was kind of nip and tuck there. But Marx and Lenin were more successful with it over a longer period of time. If you recall, they had the dictatorship of the proletariat, meaning the people. It was the people's revolution, the people's property, the party of the people, and all of that. The reality of Marxism, nevertheless, is a collectivist oligarchy, with less than 3% of the population running the show, and really on top of that 3%, a mere handful with total control at the top. We see today a recent facelift behind what used to be called the Iron Curtain. Changes nothing, ladies and gentlemen. Nothing but the words, nothing but the images. It's no longer Marxist socialism or communist socialism. Now it's democratic socialism. But the reality has remained unchanged. Now the great principle of socialism or collectivism, as we all know, we've heard it over and over again, is as follows. From each according to his ability, to each according to his need. That is the famous socialist ideal. But now, let's see what happens by the time it's written on the back of the barn. This is a copy of the Soviet Constitution, and Article 12 of the Constitution says, the principle applied to the USSR is that of socialism, from each according to his ability, to each according to his work. unquote. A slight change here. Now, Article 124 of the Soviet Constitution speaks of freedom of religion, but Article 122 of the Soviet Penal Code prohibits teaching religion to children. Article 103 says in all courts, cases are tried with the participation of people's assessors, except in cases especially provided for by law. And they have such a law. Now we compare that to the traditional American concept. In our own Constitution, our own Bill of Rights, it says Congress shall pass no law to restrict or abridge the right of freedom of speech, peaceful assembly, the right to bear arms, and so forth. Not as may be provided for by law, but no law. End of discussion. And what a difference that makes. Take a look at the back of the New World Order barn. This is a copy of the International Bill of Human Rights, and it contains several documents within it, certain covenants of various kinds of human rights. And the International Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights in this document says as follows. Article 8 guarantees the right of everyone to form or join trade unions. Then it says, no restriction may be placed on the exercise of this right other than those prescribed by law. The International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, Article 6, says, every human being has the inherent right to life. This right shall be protected by law. No one shall be deprived of his life arbitrarily. Article 9, no one shall be subjected to arbitrary arrest or detention except on such grounds and in accordance with such procedures as are established by law. Article 18, freedom to manifest one's religion or beliefs may be subject only to such limitations as are prescribed by law, etc. This is the same gimmick, ladies and gentlemen, for freedom of speech, of the press, peaceful assembly, the right to vote, and to run for office. The right to bear arms? You've got to be kidding, not even mentioned. Now, we can overemphasize this point. It can be overdone because there are, in the final analysis, certain logical limits to liberty. We all know that it's not a good idea to allow people the right to yell fire in the crowded theater. That's the analogy people use. And a person who has committed murder or some other serious crime does not have the right to travel in freedom and so forth. He's behind bars. And so in any legal system, there's always a question of balancing rights. And our system is no different. The only thing is, with the United Nations, it starts out already with the spectrum or the pendulum already swung over to one side. In our own country, I'm sorry to see that point, that balance point, which was in the beginning so far moved in the direction of individual rights and liberties, has been swinging more toward the totalitarian side. But with the United Nations documents, it starts out that way, and you know you're in trouble. The question is important because it helps focus on the main issue. Governments do not give rights, they take them away. That is their historic mission. And when the mechanism for doing so is written into the documents that supposedly guarantee your rights, you're in serious trouble. Now, what follows is not a religious thought, really. It's just practical politics. When you analyze the origin of rights, you must come to the conclusion that they come either from a divine source, they come from God, or they come from the state. No other place. Now, the original American concept, as built into our founding documents, are that they came from God. They were inalienable rights, and the purpose of government was merely to safeguard those rights. The significance of this is that if we accept the concept that rights come from the state, then we have no objection if the state wishes to take them away from us. If they can grant us our rights, then they can take them away. And that is the significance of this philosophy. Now, the United Nations position on this is very clear. Article 4 of the Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights states, quote, "The states parties to the present covenant recognize that in the enjoyment of those rights provided by the state," there it is, "in the enjoyment of those rights provided by the state may subject such rights only to such limitations as are determined by law." Of course, why not? In 1990, the United Nations published this book called Freedom of the Individual Under Law, an analysis of Article 29 of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Now, what is Article 29 of the Declaration? I'll read it to you. It's sort of like the others, but I saved this one till later. Quote, "In the exercise of his rights and freedoms, everyone shall be subject only to such limitations as are determined by law." Now, that's a whole article all by itself. Now, what we're dealing with here is a 214-page book dealing only with the question of when and how to limit human rights. Under what conditions can it be done? I mean, these guys have given a lot of thought to this. They're ready for you. Now, in all fairness, I have to read the rest of Article 29. "Your freedoms," they say, "may be limited by law, but," quote, "solely for the purpose of securing due recognition and respect for the rights and freedoms of others and of meeting the just requirements of morality, public order, and the general welfare in a democratic society." Now, let's see how the United Nations explains that. On page 175 of this little manual, here's what we find. Quote, "Such notions and terms as respect for the rights and freedoms of others, morality, public order, and general welfare escape uniform effective definition at international level. These notions and terms are expressive of imponderable concepts, the real content of which can only be ascertained on pragmatic lines in the light of the ever-varying circumstances and conditions of modern life in a world community." Which is precisely my point. These so-called guarantees, ladies and gentlemen, are nothing more than an expression of the conscience of the majority of the delegates at the United Nations. And considering the level of moral and political enlightenment of the majority of the delegates at the United Nations, at the existing United Nations, I can assure you the future will make Animal Farm look like a picnic. My audacious statement number one, the existing United Nations will bring to us oppression in the name of human rights. Now let me move on more quickly to statement number two. Slavery in the name of democracy. More words to be defined. Slavery is fairly easy to define. It's generally accepted as a state of involuntary servitude. Democracy is not so easy, and it's one of the running battles of people who study these things to try and get the point across of what is the difference between a democracy and a republic. Well, let me have a shot at it. Most people think that we have a democracy and that the whole world should live under democracy, and that is the ideal, the political ideal. If you ask them what democracy means, the general answer is, well, it means the rule of the majority, government by the majority. I say to that, okay, then I suppose a lynch mob is democracy, isn't it? Because that is the majority. There's only one dissenting vote, and he's at the end of the rope. Oh, wait a minute, they say that. Oh, that, no, we don't want that. Well, why not? Well, because that's not fair. Why isn't it fair? It's rule of the majority. Well, yeah, but, it doesn't protect the rights of the individual. Aha! How are you going to protect the rights of the individual from the majority? There's only one way, and that's to write down limitations on the power of the majority. Write those down in a code. Call it a constitution, if you will. Everybody agree to it. And work like heck to keep those words alive in the hearts and the minds of men so they don't get forgotten as to what they mean. And then when you write those things down in a constitution, you have, by definition, a republic. Specifically, a constitutional republic. And so there is a big difference between a democracy and a republic. Our founding fathers were very much aware of the difference, and in the speeches and the documents which they wrote during the time leading up to the ratification of our Constitution, they were very emphatic. They did not want this country to have a democracy. They spoke about it at length and condemned it and pointed out what a sad day it would be for posterity if we should ever evolve into a democracy. It's time to go into my little talk about the ideological spectrum, too, since we're talking about these things. Sometimes people say, well, are you on the right or are you on the left? They say, boy, Griffin, you're so far on the right, you make Genghis Khan look like a middle of the roader. Well, what do you mean by right and left? Well, let's see, right and left. I suppose Stalin was on the left and Hitler was on the right, huh? Okay. Does that hold up? No. The only analysis of the political spectrum of right or left, as I see it at least, is that at one end there is zero government and at the other end there's 100% government. So we're talking about a spectrum that goes from anarchy from one extreme to totalitarianism at the other extreme. And those who believe in limited government, like I do, like you do, we are, sorry to say, middle of the roaders. It's embarrassing. But when you take a look at it, Adolf Hitler was a totalitarian. So was Stalin a totalitarian. And all of the totalitarian concepts, no matter what name they go by, are at the 100% end or close to that end of the political spectrum. And collectivism is always at that end of the spectrum. So communism and fascism are not at opposite ends. That is a myth. And getting back to the Soviet so-called reform that's going on now. They still have not rejected collectivism. They still believe in socialism, but now they've added the word democratic socialism. And for those of us who understand what these words mean, democratic socialism or democratic collectivism, we are not encouraged by the change. We realize that there is, in fact, no change at all, just a new set of words. The new system inside the Soviet Union and the Communist bloc will fit quite nicely into the New World Order. Now, the old militarism, as I've said before, has been replaced by demagoguery and group dynamics. This is the road to power today. Collectivism wrapped in the mantle of democracy is the weapon of choice for modern totalitarians. The majority can be enticed by these devices into accepting not involuntary servitude, but voluntary servitude. The masses become dizzy with political carnivals. The national conventions come on television and the nation is glued to their television sets, watching the balloons go up and down and the people running around with their placards and all the band playing and who did you vote for? Who are you going to vote for? Their level of understanding is so surface, it's amazing. They're dizzy with this political carnival. The illusion of participating in their own destinies. They have absolutely no control over the selection of candidates or what the parties are going to stand for. Or even if they do have some input to the party platforms, the platforms are nothing. They're thrown out the minute the election is over. And yet, the people are so convinced that they are participating in the elective process, they are content with their serfdom because they voted for it. Now, this point was brought out very well 150 years ago by Alexis de Tocqueville, a Frenchman who toured America in the early 1800s, and he wrote a book called Democracy in America. And he was an amazing, astute observer of what was going on in this country. He was a great admirer of the young nation. He saw a lot of virtue, a lot of strength. He was impressed. But he saw certain things that already were creeping into the thought processes and the patterns of the American people which bothered him. And this is what he said. The Americans hold that in every state the supreme power ought to emanate from the people. But when once that power is constituted, they can conceive, as it were, no limits to it, and they are ready to admit that it has the right to do whatever it pleases. They are constantly excited by two conflicting passions. They want to be led, and they wish to remain free. As they cannot destroy either the one or the other of these contrary propensities, they strive to satisfy them both at once. They devise a sole tutelary and all-powerful form of government, but elected by the people, and they console themselves for being in tutelage by the reflection that they have chosen their own guardians. Every man allows himself to be put in leading strings, because he sees that it is not a person or a class of persons, but the people at large who hold the end of his chain. And then de Tocqueville looked ahead into the future, and with amazing accuracy, he predicted where this trend would lead. Now remember, as I read this somewhat lengthy quote, this was written 150 years ago. The first thing that strikes the observation is an innumerable multitude of men, all equal and alike, incessantly endeavoring to procure the petty and paltry pleasures with which they glut their lives. Each of them, living apart, is a stranger to all the rest. His children and his private friends constitute to him the whole of mankind. Above this race of men stands an immense and tutelary power, which takes upon itself alone to secure their gratifications and to watch over their fate. That power is absolute, minute, regular, provident, and mild. It would be like the authority of a parent if, like that authority, its object was to prepare men for manhood, but it seeks, on the contrary, to keep them in perpetual childhood. It provides for their security, foresees and supplies their necessities, facilitates their pleasures, manages their principal concerns, directs their industry, regulates the descent of property, and subdivides their inheritances. Thus, it every day renders the exercise of the free agency of man less useful and less frequent. It circumscribes the will within a narrower range and gradually robs a man of all the uses of himself. The will of man is not shattered, but softened, bent, and guided. Men are seldom forced by it to act, but they are constantly restrained from acting. Such a power does not destroy, but it prevents existence. It does not tyrannize, but it compresses, enervates, extinguishes, and stupefies a people, till each nation is reduced to nothing better than a flock of timid and industrious animals of which the government is the shepherd. Amazing. I say there could be no better description of what life will be like, in fact, of what life is already becoming in the global collectivist oligarchy called the New World Order. And now we reach the end of this thing with perhaps the most shocking statement of all, which is that the New World Order will bring to us war in the name of peace. Now, this won't take long to explain, because none of this can happen, of the things we've been talking about, without force to back it up. You can entice people or an animal into a cage, but until you close and lock that door, they can still get out. So you have to force them to stay in that cage. George Washington phrased it pretty well when he said, "Government is not reason, it is not eloquence, it is force. Like fire, it is a dangerous servant and a fearful master." Speaking of force, ladies and gentlemen, it is logical that world government means world force. No government can exist unless it has the power, the military force, to back up its decrees and to require everyone to abide by them. This is very seldom discussed by those who are talking about the New World Order, except in terms of preserving peace and preventing nuclear war. And the phrase they use to describe it is disarmament in a peaceful world. Time does not permit to go into all the details of what actually happened under the United Nations so-called peacekeeping force in the province of Katanga between 1960 and 1963. But in a nutshell, I can tell you that, and this comes primarily from the words, the books, and the speeches of UN personnel themselves, who were proud of their accomplishments. What actually happened is that when the Congo declared its independence in 1960, there was a communist by the name of Patrice Lumumba who took power and plunged the whole area into chaos. One of the provinces called Katanga, under the leadership of Moise Tshombe, wanted no part of that. It broke away. It declared its independence. It read the United Nations Charter and it said that all peoples are guaranteed the right of self-determination. And they believed it. So they declared to be self-determined, to be independent of the chaos that was going on elsewhere in the Congo. Communist Patrice Lumumba didn't want that, of course. He wanted the rich mineral and industrial resources of Katanga. So he called upon the United Nations to come in and, with the use of military force, to bring Katanga back under the rule of the Central Congolese government, which they did. They brought unprovoked war against the peaceful province of Katanga. Surprise attacks, 3, 4 o'clock in the morning, airplanes, bombing, strafing, bombing hospitals, churches, ambulances. I am not exaggerating, ladies and gentlemen. I'll just read to you one quick quotation here from the civilian doctors in Katanga. There were 46 of them. Now, these men were pro-UN prior to this. And during the bombing and strafing of civilians, they sent a series of telegrams to the world leaders, including the Pope. And this was number 22, I believe. Anyway, this is the telegram they sent. Quote, SOS to the moral conscience of the world. Implore you to intervene with all your authority to stop the terrorist bombardment of hospitals and civilian populations by UN. On our honor as physicians, we declare as lies the denials of UN Secretariat General. Insist upon inquiry here by high magistrates and presidents of medical orders of all civilized nations. Only means of convincing the world of inconceivable actions of UN, alas, dishonored. Insist upon creation of international tribune competent to judge crimes and misdeeds of UN personnel who benefit from immunity contrary to natural law. Would we be allowed to have this meeting here if the New World Order were now in full force? Not on your life. I would be speaking out against the UN. Would that be permitted under freedom of speech? During the middle of this military action against Katanga, in spite of Article 19, which guarantees freedom of expression. Remember, Article 29 says certain restrictions may apply. Okay, 1961 article in the New York Times read as follows. Asked why a UN jet attacked the post office in Elizabethville with rockets yesterday, General McCune replied that the airstrike had been ordered because the building had been used to transmit anti-UN propaganda. In other words, no animal shall kill another animal without cause. The next stage in the development of a world army is very close. We saw the precedent set of a peacekeeping force in Korea, then in Katanga. There have been 19 peacekeeping operations altogether around the world, including Desert Storm, which, as you know, was empowered not by Congress, but by the United Nations. But that is not good enough. A recent article in the Council on Foreign Relations periodical called Foreign Affairs, entitled The UN in a New World Order, made an analysis of this situation and pointed out two weaknesses in the previous operations. The weaknesses, according to the CFR, are one, they don't yet have a standing army. They always have to call up a force every time there's a new need, and they have to plead their case on a case-by-case basis. And the second weakness is that there was no line, no direct line of command from the Security Council and the Military Staff Committee and the Undersecretary General for Political and Security Council Affairs, no direct UN command line to the military forces. Up until now, all the troops have had their own national commanders who took orders from their respective governments. That is soon going to come to an end. The next stage, they said, is to establish a permanent standing UN army directly under UN command. And the machinery for that is being put into operation at this very moment. Well, the final stage will come when we turn over all of our weapons to this so-called peacekeeping force. And I'd like to refer you back to 1961, a publication that was put out by our State Department called Publication 7277, or Freedom from War, the United States Program for General and Complete Disarmament in a Peaceful World. This was put out by the Kennedy administration under the direction of appointees Secretary of State Dean Rusk and Secretary of Defense Robert Strange McNamara. And these, of course, are all CFR members. And the whole point of this proposal was summed up on the last page with this sentence. In stage three, progressive controlled disarmament would proceed to a point where no state would have the military power to challenge the progressively strengthened UN peace force. And that is the end of the line. Now, the State Department says that this document, by the way, has been superseded, but when you check out the new documents and read them, they all give reference to this document as being the source of their inspiration, and that the new documents are merely elaborating and expanding upon these proposals. So this proposal is just as much alive today as ever. The UN defines war as armed conflict between nations. When it engages in armed conflict, it is not war. The World Court has already decreed that when it engages in military conflict, it is called peacekeeping. No matter how many people are killed, no matter how much destruction, no matter whether the United Nations starts it or stops it, surprise attack or not, those, believe it or not, are peaceful bullets and peaceful bombs. Now, this is not an exaggeration. This was spelled out pretty well by President Eisenhower way back in 1968. He was interviewed in Vista magazine, which is the official publication of the Association for the United Nations, the January-February 1968 issue, interviewed by Mary Kersey Harvey, senior editor for McCall, Council on Foreign Relations publication. She described how they were talking about how the United Nations would in the future respond to a nation which did not follow the decrees of the World Court. The World Court is to say, okay, you do this, and if that nation doesn't do it, here is what President Eisenhower envisioned. He said, quote, the UN, which by now has in its possession a fleet of submarines armed with nuclear missiles deployed around the world, orders one of the submarines to proceed to the area. The world is then told that if firing breaks out for any reason whatsoever, a tactical nuclear weapon will be delivered onto the disputed territory. If this threat fails to prevent conflict, you back it up with action. End quote. Are the peacekeepers concerned about atomic weapons? Not at all. They're only concerned about who is going to use them. And they are determined to make sure it is they who will have them and no one else. And so I repeat statement number three. The New World Order will bring war in the name of peace. In fact, it has already done so. Now, the urgency is great, ladies and gentlemen. The new world order is rising around us. All you have to do is just look and see what's happening. The European common market is a giant transitional step in that direction. NATO is right now being converted into a transition agency. The World Bank and the International Monetary Fund are well on their way to becoming a new world order central bank. Our own new money, which has been announced and then delayed, but eventually going to be here soon, is a transition to an international money. Our leaders make it very clear that they are more concerned about global matters than about American matters. They place the interests of this new world order ahead of the interests of the people who have elected them to office and whom they represent. Schools teach internationalism, and our national heroes are ignored or ridiculed. Foreign aid is bleeding what little blood we have left of the American people to bring up the lower nations of the world and to bring us down so that we can be comfortably merged without any too much divergence between us. Military operations are now authorized by the United Nations, not by Congress. And the draft covenants on human rights and civil rights are right now pending before our Senate to be ratified. Some of the phrases and documents which I've been reading to you earlier are right now being considered by our elected representatives. We can still escape, but when disarmament is complete, the final option will be gone. The cage will be locked. Now, I personally believe that there are hidden forces, as I said, hidden forces at work, that this is a conspiracy. It's hard for me to believe that this is all just a mistake, a huge mistake in judgment. But as I said also at the beginning, even if one does not take that point of view, and if one refuses to believe that there are hidden agendas, if they insist on believing, if it makes you feel comfortable that our leaders are genuinely trying to do what is best but just can't seem to quite get it right, I submit that they are making a colossal blunder, because they are dragging us into a global collectivist oligarchy from which there can be no return. So what do we do about it? Well, can we change it? Not exactly. We don't have control of that organization. We're totally outvoted. They have all the voting power. Sure, we pay the bills, but we can't change it. First of all, the people in there, both the delegates from all the nations of the world, as well as the bureaucrats, like it just the way it is. They don't want to change it. They want a global collectivist oligarchy. The only option for us, ladies and gentlemen, whether we like it or not, if we wish to preserve our freedom, is to get ourselves out of that organization as soon as possible. Easier said than done. How? Well, I'll give you my 30-second lecture on apathy. I've often worried about people who were apathetic when I tried to tell them about how bad things were. They say, oh, well, yeah, nothing you can do about it, yeah. I think, what's wrong with these people? And then I realized that it wasn't their problem, it was my problem. And the reason I say that is if you imagine that you are in a life raft in the middle of the ocean and there's a small leak in the bottom of the raft, and you're going down, and nothing you can do about it, what would you do? You'd just lie there totally apathetic and sink. But if you reach around and you find a pump, an air pump, and you can pump air into the raft as fast or faster than it goes out, you are no longer apathetic. You are pumping like mad. And I realized that when people were apathetic, it's because they thought or think that there is nothing they can do about it. And that was my fault for not portraying to them that, hey, there is something we can do about it. Well, what can we do about it? Is there a realistic plan to getting out of the United Nations? The answer is yes. It's not hopeless. Now, I said possible. I didn't say easy. But it is possible. And the answer is in Congress. Every 2 years, we have a chance for a complete peaceful revolution in this country. a complete overthrow of the federal government of the United States by peaceful, lawful means every 2 years, if we'll just go out and do it. Now, that's simple. It's possible. It's doable. It's not easy. That means you've got to get out and educate your fellow Americans. But it's that simple. It can be done. Now, I'd like to close this by sharing with you a little vision of what I think a true new world order could be and should be somewhere in the future. I'm not talking about the existing UN, but I'm talking about a future one. It's not enough, I believe, it's not enough just to be against something. We ought to have a vision. We ought to be for something, which is just as important or more important than that which we are against. And I'd like to share with you my vision of a true world united in peace and brotherhood. I believe it's possible, and when it happens, it will be a federation of nations based on the exact opposite of everything that we find in the existing UN on almost every point. Instead of spouting deceptive phrases about human rights, this organization will insist on the recognition of the divine origin of those rights, and plus it will have ironclad protections with no exceptions, especially exceptions which may be provided for by law. Instead of building international armies and machines of war, it will promote the spirit of tolerance, compassion, and above all, persuasion by example, not force. And I think there we're at the very heart of the matter, not force. How on earth can you expect a nation to be at peace with its neighbor? How can you expect any nation not to use force against its neighbor when it has adopted within its own political ideology the concept of force against its own citizens? Any nation that believes in collectivism, believes in the concept of the use of force to accomplish its goals, force against its own citizens. Are foreigners more valuable than our own citizens? This community of nations that will live in peace will be made up of nations, all of which have abandoned collectivism as their ongoing ideology, and that includes our own as well. We have to clean our own house. As long as we embrace the concept of collectivism, we are going to be in wars, and we may start many of them ourselves, as we have recently. So the key to peace, then, is for all people in the world to learn the difference between individualism and collectivism, and to abandon the worn-out concept of collectivism. In other words, ladies and gentlemen, the difference between the dream and the reality is that instead of a world government of ruthless dictators and power-hungry bureaucrats, the world cries out for a true parliament of man dedicated to personal freedom and which is responsive not to the whims of government but to the needs of all mankind. That is the answer. That is the formula. Let's put it into action. Thank you.